brace yourself for a journey into the darkest corners of human nature with the Mortal Musings Podcast, available wherever you get your podcast. Join host Neil and Megan each week as they travel to the chilling world of true crime and macabre stories. From fringe socialites with hidden secrets to chilling tales from death row, they leave no stone unturned. They also bring you the strange and intriguing stories of oddities that will leave you questioning your very reality. Each episode of the Mortal Musings Podcast is a roller coaster ride through the bizarre and unsettling. New episodes drop every Wednesday. The Mortal Musings Podcast is on Spotify, Apple Podcast, and all podcast platforms. If you crave the dark, the mysterious, and the utterly bizarre, you'll want to add the Mortal Musings Podcast to your podcast playlist. The Mortal Musings Podcast with host Neil and Megan. We take the cases seriously, but not ourselves. Available wherever you get your podcast.
Blacksburg is a town of roughly 43,000 residents in Montgomery County, Virginia, in the United States. Nestled in the picturesque New River Valley, enveloped by the Appalachian Mountains, the town boasts natural beauty with its hiking trails and parks. Notably recognized as the residence of Virginia Tech, Blacksburg is affectionately known as Hokie Nation, embodying a robust school spirit and pride. However, amidst its positive attributes, the town has witnessed tragic events. In April of 2007, it became the backdrop for one of the deadliest school shootings in the United States, the Virginia Tech Massacre. Less than 10 years later, another tragedy unfolded, raising many questions about the safety of teenagers online. On the morning of the 27th of January 2016, Tammy Weeks awoke in her Blacksburg apartment, located in the Lantern Ridge area. It was a Wednesday morning, and Tammy anticipated the usual hustle and bustle of her 13-year-old daughter, Nicole Lovell, getting ready for school. However, an unusual silence enveloped the family's apartment. No sounds of the shower, the hum of the hairdryer, or the familiar clatter of someone preparing breakfast in the kitchen. Puzzled by the quietness, Tammy approached her teenage daughter's bedroom and attempted to open the door. To her surprise, however, the door resisted. Tammy quickly realized something was pushed up against her daughter's bedroom door, preventing entry. Growing increasingly concerned, Tammy called out her daughter's name, only to be met with an eerie silence. Tammy exerted all of her strength to push the door open. After a determined effort, she managed to create enough space to squeeze inside. Tammy discovered a nightstand had been strategically placed against the bedroom door. Scanning the vacant room, she noticed the open window with a breeze blowing the curtains. Further inspection revealed the absence of several items belonging to her daughter. This included black skinny jeans, a grey striped mossy oak shirt, brown and pink fat boy cowboy boots, and Nicole's beloved Minions blanket. Tammy rushed to her bedroom and grabbed her cell phone. She desperately called Nicole, but it went straight to voicemail. She then texted David, Nicole's father, but was informed that he hadn't seen Nicole, nor had he heard from her. Tammy contacted Nicole's friends and other family members, yet nobody could account for Nicole's whereabouts. Panic had already set in by this stage. It wasn't like Nicole to just vanish. but it appeared to Tammy as though she had climbed out of her bedroom window sometime in the middle of the night and then never returned. Fearing the worst, Tammy promptly reported her daughter missing to police. While waiting for their arrival, she combed the neighbourhood on foot, questioning neighbours about Nicole. During her search, Tammy encountered Stacey Snyder, a nearby resident, who shared some unsettling news. Stacey's 8-year-old daughter revealed that Nicole had shown her a photograph of a man, claiming that he was her boyfriend. Nicole had then told the little girl that she planned on sneaking out to meet him. Nicole Lovell was born to Tammy Weeks and David Madison Lovell in Radford City, Virginia, on the 3rd of May 2002. Unfortunately, just a couple of weeks before Nicole was born, David left Tammy, thrusting her into the challenges of single motherhood with a newborn. Adding to the difficulties, a couple of days after Nicole's birth, Tammy noticed changes in her daughter's abdomen. Extensive testing revealed a rare tumour in Nicole's liver, leading to a critical diagnosis. At just 10 months old, Nicole underwent a successful liver transplant, but the journey to recovery didn't end there. To survive, Nicole had to diligently take anti-rejection medication twice a day. Nicole faced even more trials at the age of 4, when she was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Subsequently, she developed acute respiratory distress syndrome, slipping into a coma for 6 months. Additionally, Nicole battled MRSA, a drug-resistant bacterial infection. Doctors gave her a mere 1% chance of survival, but against all odds, she triumphed. 8 months later, Nicole was discharged from the hospital, marking the end of her arduous health struggles. Tammy referred to her daughter as God's gift, commenting, "God got her through all that, and she fought through all that." Tammy dedicated herself to establishing a stable life for her daughter, receiving support from her parents along the way. The four of them shared a household, and when Tammy headed off to work each morning, her parents took care of Nicole. Meanwhile, David's presence in his daughter's life was sporadic, and their relationship strained as she grew older. David grappled with legal issues, serving time on a drug-related charge. By 2016, Nicole was a 13-year-old 7th grader attending Blacksburg Middle School. However, her school experience was marred by bullying. Tearfully, she confided in her mother about girls taunting her with derogatory comments about her weight and mocking the scars left by her liver transplant on her throat and stomach. Some mornings, the thought of school filled Nicole with dread, prompting her to plead with her mother for a sick note to avoid gym class. The intensity of the bullying led Tammy to occasionally allow Nicole to stay home. But even in the refuge of her own home, online harassment persisted. Battling a struggle with confidence and loneliness, Nicole openly expressed her yearning for love on social media, convinced that nobody cared about her. Her father's inconsistent presence left her longing for his love and support, creating a void that Tammy and her grandparents worked hard to fill. Despite her challenging teenage experience, Nicole maintained a strong bond with her mother and grandparents. She was navigating the awkward stage of adolescence, where she held on to aspects of her childhood while exploring the realities of the adult world. Nicole enjoyed playing with younger children in the neighborhood, adored pandas, and the movie Minions, decorating her bedroom with the characters. While she cherished these youthful pursuits, Nicole was also an active presence on social media, regularly sharing selfies on Instagram and Facebook. Faith played a significant role in Nicole's life, with her family all being regular attendees at the Auburn Baptist Church. Despite her hardships, Nicole nurtured dreams of starring on American Idol, showcasing her talent as a singer and dancer. Those familiar with the family said that Tammy went above and beyond for her daughter. As neighbour Stacey Snyder recalled, "Tammy spoiled her rotten, bought her everything she wanted, everything." Following Nicole's reported disappearance by her mother, Tammy, detectives descended upon the neighbourhood, initiating a thorough search. Tammy promptly shared the crucial tip she had received, that Nicole had told a neighbour of her intention to sneak out and meet a boyfriend. Detectives interviewed this friend, who disclosed that Nicole had identified her boyfriend as an 18-year-old college student named David.
They were sleigh riding in the snow in the back on the hill, and she was talking about this boyfriend she had that was 18 and went to college, and his name was David, and showed some text messages off of Kik and pictures, and that's what the girls told the police officers when they asked.
As detectives delved into this lead to identify David, news of Nicole's disappearance rapidly spread throughout the town of Blacksburg. The community rallied in large numbers to aid in the search, with a police source expressing uncertainty about whether it was a runaway situation or involved foul play. The investigation covered every single angle, emphasizing the urgency of the situation. Detectives stressed the significance of time, noting that Nicole had left without her daily liver transplant medication, which was essential for preventing permanent damage.
It's one of the darkest and worst things that you can deal with, but Nicole also requires medication daily for a medical condition. We know that we're going on to 36 plus hours without her not having the medication.
Thousands of missing person posters were printed, and the FBI was summoned to provide assistance. A command post was established in the family's neighborhood, with members of the Virginia Tech Corps of Cadets joining the efforts. Initially focusing on the vicinity surrounding Nicole's home, the search expanded to broader areas. Nicole's family, including her mother, father, and stepmother, actively participated in the search, fully aware of the critical time factor. David expressed concern for his daughter's health, stating, "At this point, I know she's sick. She's hurting. She's probably already into convulsions. Her liver is shutting down as we speak, wherever she is." He also appealed to her on the off chance that she had left willingly, emphasizing that they weren't angry, but just desperately wanted her home. Tammy and her father also made appeals on WSLS 10.
He's made her life miserable.
Whoever has her is, yeah.
No sleeping at night, can't eat.
She needs her medicine.
Bad.
Really bad. She's
getting critical.
At Nicole's home, detectives quickly came across a lead when they discovered that she had written the usernames and passwords of her online accounts on her bedroom wall. On the back of her door, they also came across some writing, which read, "I love David." They were still trying to figure out who David, her alleged older boyfriend, was, and turned to her social media. On her Facebook, they discovered that she was active in several teen dating groups, something which has been described as a parental nightmare. These groups consist of the full teen trifecta: sexting, cyberbullying, and strangers. They're an unmoderated public forum where anybody of any age can join and be whoever they want to be. After being bullied in school and on social media, Nicole had turned to these semi-anonymous groups for some attention, albeit from strangers. On the 1st of January, she posted a photograph of herself along with the caption, "Cute or Nah," which prompted 304 responses, most of which were extremely cruel. Just a few weeks before this, Nicole's parents had found out that she was talking inappropriately with older men online. As David recalled, "You could tell these older guys had fake profiles. Some of the things they said were way too grown up for the picture they had." Nicole had gotten a stern talking to by both Tammy and David, and they took her cell phone off her, but she later got it back. Without their knowledge, she continued chatting to strangers on social media. Persisting concerns for Nicole's parents and detective centered around the possibility that she had encountered a man named David online and was lured away from her home in the middle of the night. Despite scanning the groups that Nicole had joined, detectives couldn't locate anybody named David who was interacting with her. While the search of Nicole's online activity continued, detectives heard from her friend, Natasha Bryant. Natasha said that Nicole had told her she had a boyfriend named David. She described him as funny and really cute, and confided in Natasha about her intention to run away with him and start a family. Nicole had also posted about a boyfriend on Facebook, changing her relationship status to in a relationship, and announcing that she had recently just had her very first kiss. As detectives delved into Nicole's private Instagram account, they stumbled upon a screenshot from a conversation she had posted a few months earlier. The conversation occurred on the app, Kick, with a username named Dr. Tombstone. Kick is a popular chat app, which is attractive to teenagers due to its anonymity features. Users could sign up without providing a cell phone number, ensuring the conversations remained private from their parents' knowledge. Nicole had signed up to Kick with the username NicoleLovell1514, and detectives put in an emergency disclosure request to Kick to gain access to her account. They soon discovered that in the months leading up to Nicole's disappearance, she had been interacting with a user named Dr. Tombstone almost every single day. It was clear that they had some form of a relationship. In early January, Nicole had said to him, "Dear David, you're my crush, but I know you don't think of me like that, but I don't care. I will always be here if you're looking for a good time. I'm here when you have a bad day. I'm here and I don't want that to change. I want to be in your life for as long as you can stand me, and I know I'm annoying and I ask for too much. But I'm a girl and I have a heart and feelings, and my feelings get hurt a lot, but it's never been hurt by you. And I like that, so yeah. I'm too stupid to think that you actually want to stay in my life. But if you don't, I'll just have a life. Bye." Dr. Tombstone responded, "So here's what I'm thinking, and I'll give you some options. 1. We take a break from talking for a bit, until I get back to a semi-normal routine, and then I'll message you. A few weeks at most. 2. We keep talking just as friends and see how that goes. 3. We don't talk again. 4. We stay friends and keep in contact, and I'll be here when you need me." The last time that Nicole and Dr. Tombstone messaged was at 12:39 a.m., the night before Nicole was discovered missing from her bedroom. After this, all of Nicole's social media profiles turned silent. Detectives then made contact with Kick, and they provided them with the name connected to the Dr. Tombstone account, David A. The account was connected to the Gmail account D4Friends07, leading detectives directly to David Eisenhower, an 18-year-old freshman engineering student at Virginia Tech. David Eisenhower had spent the majority of his childhood in Washington State, attending a small Christian school. Following his sophomore year, his father's transfer to Maryland prompted his family to purchase a $620,000 home in Columbia in 2013. Eisenhower distinguished himself as a celebrated student, consistently achieving straight A's and gaining recognition as a high school track star. His competitive running journey began in middle school, and during his freshman year at Virginia Tech, he was redshirted. Gaining prominence in college track circles, he was featured by WMAR in Baltimore for a Student Athlete of the Year segment in March 2015, where he was noted for making a name for himself on the track.
"I make my personal goals achievable, like, or just out of reach of achievable. That way I'm always constantly striving to better myself. If that goal becomes a record, or if that goal is past a record, or records get broken in the process, I consider that like a milestone goal, but that's not where I ultimately want to end up."
Expressing ambitions beyond athletics, Eisenhower aspired to work for the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, an organization specializing in developing military technology. Ever felt trapped by that persistent aunt at family gatherings, bombarding you with personal questions that makes you want to bend the truth, just for them to judge you anyway? Questions about marriage, promotions, or why you haven't moved out of your parents' place. We've all been there, But when it comes to discussing your health issues with your doctor, you shouldn't have to endure a similar experience. That's where ZocDoc steps in. With ZocDoc, you can easily find and book doctors who prioritize your comfort and genuinely listen to your concerns. And it's not just a handful of doctors. We're talking about tens of thousands, each with patient reviews to help you make an informed choice. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated, in-network doctors near you, and instantly book appointments with them online. If only I had ZocDoc when I was searching for a reliable doctor, it would have made the process seamless. Go to ZocDoc.com/morbidology and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/morbidology. ZocDoc.com/morbidology. After David Eisenhower was identified as Dr. Tombstone, detectives arrived at his dorm at Virginia Tech. As he was being transferred to the police headquarters for questioning in regards to Nicole's disappearance, detectives thoroughly searched his living quarters. During the search, Eisenhower's roommate, Jeremy Becedo, arrived. Detectives informed Jeremy that Eisenhower was a person of interest in the investigation into Nicole's disappearance. Jeremy recounted that on the night that Nicole went missing, Eisenhower exhibited some unusual behavior. According to Jeremy, Eisenhower put on a pair of boots, left the dorm, and then returned in the early morning hours. Jeremy also mentioned that Eisenhower frequently kept a knife on his desk. However, during the comprehensive search of the dorm, this knife was noticeably absent. As the search continued, detectives discovered a piece of paper that had Nicole's address written on it. Over at the police headquarters, Eisenhower was presented with the kick conversations that he had with Nicole. He was informed that he was the last person that spoke with her before she vanished. He detailed how he and Nicole had first come into contact.
Mid-December, if I remember correctly, I was bored in my dorm room and logged on to a website where you go and you just talk to random strangers. It's an anonymous kind of, the website is called Omegle, if I believe correctly.
Okay.
And then she's like, hey, do you want to use my, or like message me on some app called Kick? And I was like, sure, whatever.
According to Eisenhower, Nicole had told him that she was either 16 or 17 years old. He couldn't remember which. He recounted how he and Nicole had opened up to one another and had shared an emotional connection. But when Nicole asked to meet up, he was put off. He said to detectives that when Nicole began referring to him as her boyfriend, he freaked out. But eventually he agreed to meet up with her for the first time. He admitted to driving over to Nicole's home the night that she disappeared. He said he pulled up outside and watched Nicole climb out of her bedroom window.
I get there, and then I see someone who probably looked like she was 11 years old climb out of a window, and I was like, not for me.
She walked over to the car, and Eisenhower said that he gave her a hug, and she asked if they could run away together. According to Eisenhower, he realized that Nicole was much younger than 16 or 17. He contended that he left on his own afterwards, never to see Nicole again. During the interrogation, Eisenhower rarely moved and stared directly at the detectives.
Why are you staring? Because you can tell when people are lying based on their ears and their pupils, which is how I know that you are stuck. But unfortunately, I cannot help you any further.
Eisenhower then became angry, suggesting to detectives that they needed to look for a dead body instead of focus on the last person who saw Nicole alive. When asked for his alibi for the night that Nicole disappeared, he said that he went to Walmart.
Yeah, I have a shovel in my car. Bought it from Walmart right after.
Snow shovel?
I think garden shovel. It's like a $15 shovel or something. Would it help to mention I had someone else with me when I bought the shovel for snow purposes? Her name is Natalie Keepers.
After, Eisenhower refused to answer any more questions and requested an attorney. Detectives immediately delved into Eisenhower's alibi and tracked down the friend that he was allegedly with that night at Walmart, 19-year-old Natalie Keepers. The two had crossed paths just before they began their freshman year at Virginia Tech, where they were both studying engineering. They had a fling in the summer, but became close friends as they entered the engineering program together. Keepers had been born into a family of strong Christian faith, and her parents, Sarah and Tim, said that she had been a good influence on her younger siblings. Much like Eisenhower, Keepers had a bright future ahead of her. She had interned at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and had led science experiments in her church's Bible school. She played junior varsity soccer at Hammond High School, but she wasn't a standout athlete like Eisenhower had been. Her interests were more diverse, as she joined the math team and Model United Nations. She had also been a member of the National Honor Society and the National Science Honor Society. She had graduated high school in the top 15% of her class with a grade point average of 3.29. As she began her freshman year at Virginia Tech, she had ambitions to follow in her father's footsteps as an aerospace engineer at NASA. Natalie Keepers was tracked down at her boyfriend's dorm room and brought over to the police headquarters to be interviewed. Detectives told her that she was there to be questioned in relation to Nicole's disappearance after Eisenhower identified her as his alibi for that night. At first, she denied any knowledge, before suddenly changing her tune and becoming unusually open. She told detectives that she wanted to help in their investigation and come clean. But first, she asked if her name would be mentioned, because she didn't want any angry parents. Keepers then stunningly revealed that Nicole was dead, and that she had played a role in the planning of her murder. According to Keepers, Nicole had been killed by David Eisenhower, the man she had been speaking with online. Keepers told detectives that she had never met, nor had she even spoken to Nicole, but despite this, when Eisenhower asked if she wanted to help him kill her, she agreed. She said that over the course of a few weeks, she and Eisenhower discussed several ways to kill Nicole. They considered drugging her, making it look like a suicide, and knocking her unconscious and leaving her to die of exposure. Keepers said that they then eventually settled on what she described as the official plan. This was to lure Nicole out of her home with the promise of a romantic walk with Eisenhower, grab her from behind, cover her mouth, and then slit her throat. But first, they needed to settle on a location. The more rural, the better. She said to detectives, he said he was looking for a good spot to talk to her so that it was alone and out of the public eye. Keeper suggested Craig Creek Road, an isolated and mountainous area just outside Blacksburg. Once settled on the murder location, Eisenhower and Keepers purchased a shovel and some cleaning supplies. Keepers became emotional as she denied that she was present when Nicole was killed.
If I was there, I would have stopped it. I would have stopped it. I wouldn't have let him do anything. Even if I had to see him do that to her. And the first thing I would have done is start the car and drove and left because I didn't think David could do such a thing.
As Keepers was being interrogated, detectives were examining her cell phone. The night that Nicole went missing, she had texted Eisenhower for an update on their plan. He chillingly responded, "It's done." Keepers told detectives that after Nicole was killed, Eisenhower left her body in the woods. However, after her disappearance gained more traction than they had anticipated, they decided to move her. Eisenhower had texted Keepers that they needed Nicole's body to not be found for at least a week. He said that after that, all of the evidence connecting them to the murder would be gone. He said that thousands of children go missing each year, and they had hoped that Nicole would become another one of these grim statistics. In another message, Eisenhower had written, "I looked up what police do for missing kids. There are 12,000 missing kids in Virginia. They do basically nothing. Like, it's sad. They get 30 reports of runaways a day, 87% that don't return after a few days are never found. I guess we figure out how people commit mass murder. Keepers and Eisenhower then drove out to the location where he had left Nicole's body in the woods on Craig Creek Road. Keepers admitted to helping Eisenhower drag Nicole's lifeless body into his car. And after turning off their cell phones, they drove her south of Blacksburg. Keeper said that Eisenhower had planned to bury Nicole on property near his grandparents' home, outside Glax. Instead, they drove just inside the North Carolina line, to a mountainous section of Surrey County, where they stripped Nicole naked and cleaned her with bleach to try and get rid of evidence. They then left her on the side of the road and drove over to Walmart, where they brought more cleaning supplies. From here, they went to McDonald's, where they brought drinks and disposed of bloody cleaning wipes, and then on to West Virginia, where they dumped some of Nicole's belongings in the New River. The two then returned to their respective dormitories, where Keepers texted Eisenhower, "I smell like cleaning supplies. I mean, I was close to a lot of blood." After making the confession, Keepers told detectives that she had willingly participated in the planning and disposal of Nicole's body because it made her feel like part of a special secret club.
"He made me feel like I was being a part of some like secret club that like only me and him were a part of."
She said to detectives that it was the best club in the world because Eisenhower understood her. She referred to Eisenhower as a sociopath, and to herself as a sociopath in training. In another text message sent just minutes before Keeper was taken to the police headquarters to be interviewed, she had warned Eisenhower with a single word, "Police." She was then asked about this text message. She said that Eisenhower had wanted her to give him a 24-hour head start if she were ever brought in to be questioned. They had come up with a code, and that was for Keepers to use her one phone call to call him and talk about vomiting on the first day that they met. She explained that Eisenhower had planned on running away and changing his identity if detectives ever identified them as suspects in Nicole's murder. However, by the time the text message was sent, Eisenhower was already a prime suspect in the disappearance of Nicole. Following Keeper's confession, she drove out with detectives to various sites, including dumpsters where they disposed of evidence. Detectives were able to recover a bleach bottle inside a Walmart bag and blue plastic gloves. Keepers also pointed out tire tracks from Eisenhower's car and their footprints in the blood-spattered snow where Nicole was killed. She attempted to find the knife that Eisenhower had disposed of in a wooded area, but was unsuccessful. Finally, in Keeper's dorm room, they came across a bloody gym bag. Inside, they found a bloody stick and Nicole's blood-spattered Minions blanket. Natalie Keepers was subsequently charged with one felony count of improper disposal of a dead body and one misdemeanor count of accessory after the fact in the commission of a felony. Armed with her confession, detectives promptly charged David Eisenhower with Nicole's murder. As he and Keepers were booked into jail, detectives descended on the area that Nicole said they had disposed of Nicole's body. They arrived at a wooded area just off Route 89 inside Surrey County, North Carolina. The location was about 7 miles south of Galax and less than 2 miles outside of Grayson County, two areas that Eisenhower was familiar with. He had family who owned land in both areas. Just at the side of the road, they came across Nicole's nude body. One of the detectives recollected to A&E.
"Nicole was located off the main road, going off the side of a mountain. She was stabbed a number of times. She was not buried. They apparently had just tossed her from the edge."
Nicole was transported to the Office of Medical Examiner in Roanoke, Virginia, for an autopsy. The pathologist, Dr. Gail Suzuki, found that Nicole had been stabbed 14 times, mostly to the head and neck, but also several to the chest. There were external bruises and scrapes to her body, as well as bruising to the inside of her scalp. Nicole had also sustained a broken bone to her neck that was caused by blunt force trauma. Evidence indicated that Nicole was still alive when she sustained this injury. As news of the discovery swept throughout the area, Tammy spoke at a press conference to pay tribute to her daughter.
Her favorite color was blue. Nicole was a very lovable person. Nicole touched many people throughout her short life.
The next day, hundreds of people gathered for a vigil for Nicole at the River of Life Church. Pastor Mike Honaker asked for those in attendance to pray for Nicole's family and to try and do more to protect and guard children. Blacksburg Middle School announced that they would have extra counsellors on hand when school resumed on the Monday. Just a few days later, the charges against Keepers were upgraded. She was additionally charged with accessory before the fact to willfully, deliberately, and with premeditation kill and murder Nicole in the first degree. Keepers' defense attorney Christopher Olin requested bail, telling the judge, "We understand the allegations are disturbing and serious, but they are just allegations." He said that Keepers had been struggling behind bars, where she was being kept in isolation for her own safety. He also said that she was allergic to the gluten in the food that was being served at the jail. Keepers spoke to the judge during her court appearance and described how she had self-harmed since she was an eighth grader. Much like Nicole, she too had been bullied at school and said that she had been in therapy to overcome the years of bullying and had been on the antidepressant Prozac. Judge Robert Vyers Jr. turned on the request, ordering that Keepers remain behind bars. Then on the 3rd of February, a steady stream of cars filled the parking lot of a McCoy funeral home as people came together to pay their respects to Nicole. Among those in attendance was Jane Lillian Vance, an instructional assistant at Blacksburg Middle School. She chatted with some of the reporters outside and said that she had bonded with Nicole over her love for animals. She commented, "Her smile. Everybody's going to tell you that they'll miss her smile because she had some kind of magic under her eyes and around her mouth. I will miss her potential. I looked forward to Nicole years from now." A family friend, Katie Wilson, poignantly said of Nicole, "She fought so hard to get to this point in her life, and you have people like that, that just take her innocence from her." With both Eisenhower and Keepers behind bars, the investigation into Nicole's murder continued. Detectives wanted to figure out exactly why Eisenhower had wanted Nicole dead, but they had an idea. He was a 19-year-old man, whereas Nicole was just a 13-year-old girl, and he had clearly been grooming her over the internet. Step into the new year with a resolution to declutter and organize, and let Smart Labels be your guiding light. Say goodbye to the chaos of misplaced items and tangled messes. Welcome a world of order and efficiency with their cutting-edge app and QR labels. Simply purchase their color-coded smart labels from their website, qrsmartlabels.com, Amazon or Walmart. Then download the Smart Labels app from the Apple App Store or Google Play to effortlessly create a digital inventory of each box. No more lost moments searching for that one item you know you packed away somewhere, and ensure that your New Year's resolution to be more organized becomes a reality. Embrace the future of streamlined living, where technology meets tidiness. Make sure to click the link in my show notes to simplify your storage organization today. Detectives soon received a tip from a man named Bryce Dustin that brought the motivation to the forefront. Bryce and Eisenhower had begun communicating through online gaming, although they never had met in person. Nevertheless, they had built up a friendship, and they had a level of trust in one another. They had exchanged phone numbers and texted quite frequently for over the previous year. Eisenhower had gone to Bryce around a year earlier, asking for advice on how to kiss a girl. According to Bryce, these conversations took a dark turn, when Eisenhower later asked him if he knew where to hide a body. At first, Bryce thought that Eisenhower was joking. Before this conversation, Eisenhower had asked Bryce for some advice. He said that he had met a girl at a party, but later learned that she was underage. While he didn't name the girl in the text messages, he said that he was concerned because she wanted to be with him and wanted him to be her boyfriend. Bryce said to detectives, he was older and she was younger. He was saying that she was going to expose him. Bryce had suggested a plan for Eisenhower to just ignore the girl until she got over it and moved on. A couple of days later, however, Eisenhower texted Bryce once more and told him that the plan had failed. He then added, I need to know where to hide a body. Bryce never responded to the text message, but then when he saw Eisenhower on the news charged with Nicole's murder, he put two and two together and called detectives. With this new information, detectives firmly believed that Eisenhower had killed Nicole because she was going to expose him as a child predator. When detectives spoke with keepers about the motivation behind the murder, she provided them with some more information. While Eisenhower maintained to detectives that the first time he met Nicole was when she climbed out of her bedroom window, this wasn't the truth. Keepers told detectives that he had met Nicole before, at a local high school party both had attended. Eisenhower had told keepers that he had blacked out at the party and woke up the next day in a ditch. A friend had told him that he had been making out with a girl at the party, and shortly thereafter he began receiving messages from Nicole on Kick. She told him that they had messed around, which he understood to mean sexually. According to keepers, Eisenhower had feared that he had gotten Nicole pregnant and that she had wanted to be in a relationship with him. He also alleged that Nicole had threatened to take her own life unless he visited her. While Eisenhower may have been fearful that he got Nicole pregnant, her autopsy showed otherwise. In July, Eisenhower and keepers were indicted by a grand jury. Eisenhower was indicted on charges of first-degree murder, abduction, and hiding a body. Keepers was indicted on charges of being an accessory to kidnapping and murder and helping to hide a body. While many had called for prosecutors to seek capital punishment against Eisenhower, they couldn't because there was no physical evidence that he had sexually assaulted Nicole. Prosecutors would have had to show he had abducted her with the intent to sexually assault her in order to pursue capital murder charges against him. It was decided that they would stand trial separately, with Eisenhower standing trial first in March of 2017, followed by keepers later in the month. Those dates were then pushed back as it was decided that some of keepers' interrogation couldn't be entered into evidence. The judge had ruled that detectives hadn't read keepers' her Miranda rights early enough. David Eisenhower's trial began on the 6th of February 2018. During opening statements, it became apparent that his defense was to blame Natalie Keepers. Defense attorney John Lichtenstein stated, "The evidence in the case will be that the presence of somebody else at that scene and the presence of somebody else who was deeply motivated to commit that murder will leave you with that reasonable doubt." He described Keepers as somebody having a history of mental illness, a fascination with knives, and that she was excited when discussing the murder of Nicole. During the prosecution's opening statements, Mary Petit refuted that Keepers was to blame for Nicole's murder. She confidently said to the jury, "He has a problem, and his problem is Nicole Lovell." She revealed for the first time that Eisenhower's DNA was discovered underneath Nicole's fingernails and that her blood was discovered in the trunk of his car. She described how Nicole had snuck out of the house for what she believed was a date with Eisenhower. Instead, she was lured to the woods, stabbed numerous times, and then left to die in the snow. The motivation, the prosecution said, was that Eisenhower was afraid Nicole would expose their relationship. Testimony then promptly got underway with Tammy Weeks, Nicole's mother. She described finding Nicole missing from her bedroom with the window wide open. When she was asked when the last time she saw her daughter was, she softly replied, in her coffin. The jury then got to hear evidence about how Eisenhower was connected to the Kik account that had been speaking with Nicole. Forensic scientist Corey Bartow testified about Eisenhower's fingerprints. They had been found on a bottle of bleach found in the back seat of his car and the shovel that was also found in his car. Keeper's fingerprints were also discovered on the same bottle of bleach and shovel. The fingerprints that had been discovered on the shovel were in blood. Furthermore, detectives had found a pair of bloodstained boots that belonged to Keeper's in her dorm room. They were spattered with blood, and DNA testing showed that this blood had come from Nicole. Fingernail clippings from Nicole had contained foreign DNA. Keeper's DNA was ruled out, but Eisenhower's DNA couldn't be ruled out. Within Eisenhower's car, forensic experts also found Nicole's blood on the tire, trunk, and back seat, as well as on a container of wet wipes and on the shovel. Deanna Jones from the Blacksburg Police Department testified next, telling the jury about the GPS on Eisenhower's car. It showed his movements on the night of Nicole's murder, placing him at her apartment in Cray Creek Road, where she was killed. The evidence against Eisenhower was so overwhelming that after 2 days of testimony, his defense team asked the judge to rearrange him. Eisenhower then entered pleas of no contest to all of the charges he was facing. This meant that he acknowledged that there was enough evidence to convict him, but didn't admit that he actually committed the crimes. Essentially, it has the same effect as a guilty plea. Eisenhower then waived his right to a trial, along with his right to defend himself or make an appeal in the case. The judge then found Eisenhower guilty on all of the charges against him, putting an end to the murder trial. If the trial were to continue, the jury were set to hear the series of text messages between himself and Keepers, as well as messages between himself and Nicole. Detectives had also extracted information from his computer. He had visited websites about human decomposition and had researched how long it takes for police to search for somebody after they run away. He had also conducted searches on how long it takes to burn a body, what melts through flesh, and how bodies are identified. Outside of court, Tammy choked back tears as she said to reporters, "I was blessed to be Nicole's mother, to be her friend for 13 years. We fought every fight together. She was a great and beautiful girl." David Eisenhower returned to court on the 26th of June to be sentenced for Nicole's murder. All of Nicole's family were in attendance and provided victim impact statements, highlighting their loss from her murder. Her father, David, said, "There is nothing that will happen in this courtroom that will fix it. You cannot put a band-aid on my daughter's life." Tammy recounted celebrating what would have been her daughter's 16th birthday at her gravesite that year, and said that everything reminded her of her daughter. Eisenhower's defense team were hoping for a more lenient sentence, and they called on a neuropsychologist who concluded that he had autism. While very intelligent, he was bad at handling situations where there were no clear rules. They said that Eisenhower couldn't deal well with anxiety and fear. This evidence contrasted with the findings of a tech psychologist who had seen Eisenhower in the fall of 2015. And concluded that he tried to manipulate those around him. David Eisenhower was then asked whether he wanted to make a statement. He stood up and stared down at a note he had written.
"I am sorry for the pain that my actions have caused Nicole Lovell and her family. Nothing can ever undo what has been done, and for that, I am deeply, sincerely, and forever sorry."
Judge Robert Turk then sentenced David Eisenhower to 60 years for first-degree murder, 10 years for abduction, and 5 years for concealing Nicole's body. He ordered that the sentences run consecutively for a total term of 75 years, with 25 to be suspended after Eisenhower served 50 years. The remainder would be served on probation. With David Eisenhower beginning his sentence behind bars, Natalie Keepers was preparing for her own trial. However, in August of 2018, she pleaded guilty to helping conceal Nicole's body. This meant that she would be facing trial on the more serious charge of being an accessory to murder. During opening statements, prosecutor Mary Petit laid out the case against Keepers, telling the jury, "The reason we're here is because Natalie Keepers helped plan this murder." She detailed how she and Eisenhower had purchased a shovel together, discussed the murder, and then planned out the spot to carry it out. She said that Keepers referred to herself as a sociopath in training, and highlighted how she told detectives that she felt like she was part of a secret club. Defense attorney John Robertson, in his opening statements, stated, "The primary question you will have to ask yourself and answer is what Natalie Keepers intended." Most of Keepers' confession was played aloud for the jury, and it proved to be damning. It showed that she had taken part in the planning of Nicole's murder and the disposal of her body. In the interrogation, Keepers had often rambled about things that were completely unrelated to the case. She even told detectives she had dated a secret government assassin. The majority of the evidence presented was the same evidence presented during Eisenhower's trial, including the forensic evidence that linked both him and Keepers to Nicole's murder. The text messages between Keepers and Eisenhower were also presented, during which they spoke about Nicole's death.
"Keepers, we can run a game plan. Eisenhower, yeah, message her. Ask to come over, delete my name, all info associated with me, and kick on her phone and iPad, or iPod, sorry. Eisenhower, then GTFO.
The evidence against Natalie Keepers was overwhelming.
"We, the jury, unanimously find the defendant, Natalie Marie Keepers, guilty of being an accessory before the fact of first-degree murder."
In the end, she was found guilty for her role in Nicole's murder. During her sentencing phase, she was asked whether she had anything to say. She turned to Nicole's family.
"I cried for your family every night. I'm so sorry. I wish I could have stopped. I never intended for this to happen."
Natalie Keepers was ultimately sentenced to 40 years in prison. The pursuit of affirmation has long been a fundamental aspect of human nature. However, with the widespread influence of social media, individuals can now cast their emotional nets into a vast global abyss, teeming with unknown persons. Nicole was grappling with the aftermath of relentless bullying when she sought solace in the digital realm, hoping to forge meaningful connections. Little did she know that this seemingly boundless online space would prove to be a double-edged sword, ultimately costing her her life. Well, besties, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening, and I'd like to say a massive thank you to my new Patreon supporter, Joe. If you'd like to join us up on Patreon, the link is in the show notes. Morbidology is just a one-woman team, so the support up on Patreon seriously goes such a long way, and I really, really do appreciate the support. I mentioned it last week, but I'd like to mention again that my new true crime book, Killers Caught, was published last year. You can purchase it on Amazon and in all good bookstores, as well as a few supermarkets in America, including Walmart and Target. If any of you are up on Facebook, I'd love for you to join my private Facebook group for the podcast. Just search for Morbidology and it should show up. Remember to check us out at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.